This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. And we want to make sure to alert you about something coming up later this hour. Two generations of vets, two voices, one from the war in Iraq, the other from Vietnam, sharing their after-the-war stories. It's an unforgettable conversation about sacrifice, about service, and the legacy of PTSD. Stay tuned for that. Also, Alan Alda, who had one career conveying the horrors of war to TV viewers of the TV series MASH, now has a second career explaining science to the unscientific. He wants to know who your favorite scientist is, by the way, the one you might go back in time to meet or visit in the lab and look over their shoulder. You can tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Is it Albert Einstein, Jane Goodall, Isaac Newton? We'd love to hear from you. But first, consider the budding legacy of Edward Snowden, changing the debate on national security with his leaks of classified documents, changing the U.S.-Russian relationship. President Obama yesterday answered the decision by Vladimir Putin to let Snowden have asylum in Russia by canceling a scheduled face-to-face summit meeting later this year. But what if you were told that domestic and foreign surveillance data, obtained often under questionable circumstances, has been helping to put people in prison on drug charges for the past two decades, way before Snowden? Then what if you were told that the evidence from that surveillance is actually kept out of court and away from lawyers and judges in a complicated and dubious-sounding process called parallel construction? Reuters reporter John Schiffman helped break this story of seemingly needless secrecy that appears to bypass our basic rules of evidence in a court of law. John Schiffman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let me just start by asking, what can the Special Operations Division of the DEA, which consists of a bunch of other organizations within the sort of law enforcement establishment in Washington, what can SOD do that maybe even the CIA can't accomplish with its use of evidence and ability to manipulate possibly even trials in the United States?
Well, what the Special Operations Division has been doing since the late 90s is it has been sending along tips that it gets from all over the country and all over the world from foreign governments, tips gleaned from NSA wiretaps, tips gleaned from informants, domestic wiretaps that are legally done in the United States, and they're passing them on to agents all over the country. And what they're doing is they're investigating people for ordinary drug crimes inside the United States and money laundering crimes, not national security crimes. Under the law, the intelligence community shares with law enforcement information they get about crimes. The issue that comes up here is not so much the process by which they get the information and use it. It's what they do afterward, which is they conceal it from defendants at trial. And that's something that some critics say is unconstitutional.
Let's talk for a moment about this database, DICE, that actually is the name of these tips that are assembled and archived and passed along, and this has been going on for years.
Sure. The DICE database is a database of all legally acquired telephone numbers during drug investigations. So if they're investigating you, they send out a subpoena or a search warrant, they get all of the numbers of all the people you're dialing. And if they're investigating me in a totally separate investigation, they get all the numbers I'm dialing and all the numbers dialing me. They put both of those into a giant computer, the DICE database, which also includes license plate data and internet information, all collected legally. And they use that to connect the dots between different cases. And by using all that data to connect the dots, they alert other agents across the country or police departments about making these connections. The issue that critics see is that they're not disclosing this during trial, that this is how these cases are starting.
So an attorney representing someone in a drug crime case could be hearing from a client saying something like, there's no way they can know this. There's no way they can understand this. There's just no possible evidence that this occurs. And the attorney might be saying, well, they've got something or they're working a hunch or but it turns out that the evidence is, in fact, completely hidden from defendants?
Well, what the typical case here that the DEA, I met with them, and this is their typical scenario, is they'll get one of these tips from one of these four different ways, through the DICE database, through the NSA intercepts, through the informants, through the legally acquired domestic wiretaps, they'll pass it along, but they pass it along in a stage whisper, if you will, and they say, don't let anyone know. They use a concept they call parallel construction. So a police officer or a DEA agent will identify a suspect. They'll know that this person is going to be in a certain area. They'll pull them over for speeding or rolling through a stop sign or some pretextual traffic stop. And lo and behold, inside, they'll find a kilo of cocaine or they'll find some drugs or something. And the person who's arrested thinks that the cops just got lucky or the DEA just got lucky. And in the reports, the agents and officers are instructed to start the investigation by saying, I was driving down the street and I noticed that a car went through a stop sign or failed to signal when it turned. And the problem with this is that you get into pretrial discovery obligations of the prosecutors to turn over evidence that could be exculpatory, helpful to the defense in a variety of different ways. And usually the defense asks for all evidence and they have a laundry list of things that they would ask for, but they don't know to ask for this. And you can't ask for what you don't know exists.
Now, there are two ways of looking at this. There's the strictly sort of constitutional approach, but there's also the question of, you know, if they're right, if they're actually nabbing drug criminals, isn't this a bit of a technicality here? How do you answer that?
Well, you know, I talked with about a dozen current or former agents, and about half of them said, look, you know, we use this to catch some pretty bad guys. They've been doing it for 20 years. They do it almost every day. But, you know, I also talked to a prosecutor who said that a DEA agent once lied to him, told him that there was an informant was the original tip in the case when actually it came from an NSA wiretap, he later learned. And he was furious. He said, you know, this is not the way that we should be comporting ourselves if agents are misrepresenting their investigations when cases go to trial before a judge and before a jury. You know, I'm a lawyer. I was a little surprised that this kind of thing goes on, that agents are directed to start their investigation with step two instead of step one.
John Schiffman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So what do prosecutors and judges think of this sort of thing? A systematic program to keep crucial evidence secret and a federal program that may be encouraging prosecutors and investigators to lie in open court. With me now, Nancy Gertner, Harvard professor of law and former federal judge. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's just go straight at it. Can you think of a case where something like this might have actually occurred in one of your courtrooms, and the notion of starting on step two rather than step one and suppressing evidence from open court? What do you think of that principle?
Well, the point is that I have never heard of it before. I was a criminal defense lawyer for 24 years and a judge for 17, and I had never heard of this before. And yes, there were cases that began with traffic stops, you know, with the fact of the cops sort of happening on someone doing something they shouldn't. In most of those cases, at some point they had to disclose, or they did disclose, how they focused on the person. In other words, I never saw anything that smacked of parallel construction. The prosecutors would say, we had been investigating this person in New York. We thought he was a drug dealer. We then wired ahead the information to the cops on the Mass Pike, and they waited until this individual changed lanes the wrong way. But the defense in that situation got the earlier investigation. And the point is that you go through the earlier investigation and you say, was there any illegality in the earlier investigation? Were any rules violated? Were wiretaps legal? Was exculpatory evidence disclosed? You can track how this arrest that was on the Mass Pike, you know, traced to legal or illegal activities. If you begin the story with a stop on the Mass Pike, you lose the ability to enforce rights and due process all the way prior to that point.
So in your view, would a case that, you know, where we discover what the original tip was and it begins before the stop on the street, is that challengeable all the way down? Is the entire sequence of evidence challengeable because we don't know step one?
If all across the country they're going to be just step two prosecutions, can people challenge them all across the country? There's going to have to be an investigation of what kind of misrepresentations were going on in court to prosecutors and defense lawyers, and more significantly to judges. We're going to have to go back and roll the dice back all the way to try to figure out how that's happened. I mean, consider it this way. Let's say I go into your your room and I illegally search your room. I come up with all sorts of bad stuff. I put it on, you know, I put it in a report. The report makes it, gets to a police officer. The police officer is told, just watch you until you jaywalk. You jaywalk. And then no one has to disclose that there had been a prior illegal search. I mean, that essentially undoes all the protections of criminal procedure that we've been working towards for 50 years.
All right. So hearing you describe it, there seems to be a real sense of outrage in your voice about this practice and our ability to even go back and try to correct cases that may have been, I hesitate to use the word, manipulated.
Right. No, I mean, it's, you know, when you step back 50,000 feet, the Bill of Rights really was intended to obviate the need to simply trust the executive branch. We don't say, you know, as a society, trust the executive branch. We create checks and balances. Without information, there's no way that judges and defense lawyers and even prosecutors can check, can find out whether the course of the procedures comported with the Constitution. And we are a constitution about procedural protection. So this is really substantial. The other part of this is that this is really, you know, as some people would describe it, mission creep. It's one thing to talk about special rules for the NSA and the FISA court. It's quite another thing to talk about special rules for what is essentially ordinary crime. That's precisely what the Bill of Rights, you know, should be about. The courts have a way of dealing with confidential information. There are many times when I was a judge that there would be an informant that that the prosecutor didn't want to disclose, or there may have been classified information. You get all of that. Everyone knows that it's going on. The judge looks at things in camera, which means behind closed doors. And at least a judicial officer makes a determination of whether the information was legally or illegally obtained. All of this is taking place behind closed doors, solely under the rubric of the executive. And that is completely inconsistent with what we do in criminal justice.
So is this another case where we have to rewrite the Bill of Rights, incorporating notions of digital databases that live essentially forever?
Well, that's a great point. We have to, I don't know about rewriting the Bill of Rights, but we certainly have to figure out how to ensure those protections in a digital world. That's for sure.
All right. Do you think this is more serious than Snowden?
You know, that's hard to say. It's more serious in the sense that it's ordinary crime. You know, there's ordinary crime like drug prosecutions, et cetera. And then we have national security crime, and we've come up with all sorts of exceptions to transparency and to rules for national security crime. Ordinary crime should not be subject to special rules.
Well, I hear you grappling with it. Thanks so much for allowing us into your mind there. Nancy Gertner is a Harvard professor of law and a former federal judge. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Alan Alda about his favorite scientists. We've asked you to pick any moment in history and any scientists whose shoulder you'd love to look over. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and stay with us, scientists. The experience of the Vietnam War was explained in part to a resistant America by a TV show called MASH about a field hospital in the Korean War, starring a doctor named Hawkeye, played by actor Alan Alda.
I just wanted to be quiet. She smothered her own baby.
Why did you make me remember that?
You had to get it out in the open. Now we're halfway home.
That story of a combat flashback shows Alda's incredible range as an actor. It's a gripping emotional scene from a performer who's possibly gotten more laughs on television than anyone in history. Here's another example of Alda's range.
In this program, we'll find out how utterly deluded we are as we join in experiments revealing just how sneaky and underhanded our brains can be. And we find out why we sometimes make decisions that make no sense at all.
That's the 7-time Emmy-winning actor from MASH, performer in Glengarry Glen Ross, The West Wing, The Aviator, hosting the PBS series Scientific American Frontiers. Alda's legacy as someone who has helped explain science to a resistant America was honored this week with a Lifetime Achievement Award at an event sponsored by Scientific American and Macmillan Science and Education. Alda told us he graciously accepts the lifetime achievement business as long as we all agree there's probably more to come on his resume.
It's funny. To get a Lifetime Achievement Award in acting does make me feel a little leery of the lifetime thing. But to get any kind of an award for science communication, it just thrills me. So I don't care what they say about lifetime or not.
You've done so many different kinds of things in the biology realm, physics realm. What's the most difficult piece of science you've tried to explain?
At all the dinner parties I've been to, when they discovered the Higgs particle, everybody would be asking me what the Higgs particle was. And I say, well, you know, there are these particles. Then sometimes they'd say, wait a minute, what's a particle? It's very, very hard for people on the outside of science to get even the basic terms right. And that's why I helped start this Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, because I want scientists to talk in plain language with clarity and vividness about their work so that we all have, in a way, a leg up on these very difficult subjects that really rule our lives now. And it's not good for us not to be able to talk about what rules our life.
What I find often is that when scientists get the idea that they can entertain an audience, they can really wow an audience with what mm-hmm. they're saying, it reinvigorates their whole passion about their subject, and they stop speaking in impenetrable sort of jargon, and they really become performers. Have you experienced that at Stony Brook?
I have. Yeah, I have. And I don't know if I call it performing so much, although there probably is an element of that in it. But what I would focus on is the pleasure that you get from connecting to another person. And if you connect to a room full of 500 people or 1,000 people, there's even more pleasure in it. But the connection between the scientist and the crowd is such a palpably exciting experience that I think it does energize them and make them want to communicate more and better. And the reason it does, I think, is that we forget sometimes that we're herd animals, that we exist in communities better. The worst punishment you can visit on somebody is solitary confinement, outside of some kinds of physical torture. But that's a mental torture, because we need other people. And the pleasure you get from connecting with them is a driving force, I think, in better communication.
How frustrating has it been for you when good communicators can actually shut down scientific truth? And I'm thinking of areas like climate change and areas like the theory of evolution and make political points that sometimes overmatch scientists who do have a Nobel Prize-winning grasp of their material.
Yeah, well, it's saddening, and it makes me work harder to help scientists infuse what they say with not only their knowledge, but their passion and their ability to connect with the minds of the people they're talking to and not just spray information at them. Because science is, as Kahneman said, I think, science is best done with that part of the brain that is analytic and takes its time and is not emotional, but science is best explained with that part of the brain that's emotional and connective and collaborative and intuitive. That's the part we light up with an unfamiliar subject. At least that's the theory I'm working on.
So many people have experienced your career as an actor and have gotten so much joy from that. You clearly have gotten an extraordinary amount of joy being able to look over the shoulder of scientists as they work in the many scientific communication ventures that you've been involved with, Scientific American, PBS, all of them. If you could choose any scientist down through history that you could sort of teleport yourself back to look over their shoulder while they were working and then have the ability to explain that experience to one of your good friends, who would it be? What kind of a scientist would it be, do you think?
I think it would have to be Marie Curie, because I've spent a lot of the last 6 years writing a play about her, and I think I know her to some extent. To be able to have a cup of tea with her and just talk about her life and her work, and to have her explain to me what she was doing would be thrilling to me, because she's my hero. Everything stood in her way, and she didn't let anything permanently stand in her way. She just overcame every obstacle.
First female Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah, and not many people know that they didn't want to give her the prize. They wanted to give it to her husband, Pierre, because they didn't believe that a woman really did most of that work. And then when he pleaded with them and they decided to give it to both of them, plus Henri Becquerel, they said, yeah, but he'll get up and accept it and she'll sit in the audience and watch. And that's how they did it.
Well, the scientific story of Marie Curie is unbelievable. One of the many stories that you've had the privilege of telling and that we've had the privilege of hearing. Alan Alda, thanks so much.
Great to talk with you, John. Thank you.
Alan Alda is a 7-time Emmy Award-winning actor and writer, as well as visiting professor and advisory board member with the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. We've been asking you, which scientist would you want to have a cup of tea with?
If there was any scientist that I could look over the shoulder of, it would have to be Charles Darwin. He was instrumental in formulating the theory of evolution by natural selection, which is the best answer we have for the diversity of life on Earth, and has helped put into context many mysteries in medical science since its formulation more than 150 years ago.
Alexandra Graham Bell would be my favorite. I can only imagine how exciting it must have been for him to hear his voice electronically transmitted over a set of wires for the first time. I wonder if he knew what that invention would do to our world today.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your favorite scientist down through history.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Plug it in, turn it on, rev it up. What is going on with the Tesla? No, not the scientist inventor Nikola Tesla that many of you would love to go back in time to visit. And keep your suggestions coming, by the way. No, not that Tesla. The Tesla electric car, the super expensive Roadster, the top of the line S car, or the soon to be introduced X model. The company made a surprise profit last quarter. Sales are up. And the stock is up more than 300% this year. Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Has Tesla entered the big time here? Welcome, Paul.
Hey, John. Good to be with you.
What do you think?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. You got to remember that these guys are soaring, but at the same time, even with a 25% bump up in production for the second quarter, they're rolling out, what, about as many Teslas in a quarter as Ford builds F-Series pickups in a day or two?
But what if you reduce the frame to just other electric car models? Tesla is competing very favorably, and the whole way of marketing is a kind of Silicon Valley approach as opposed to the traditional auto industry approach. That's part of the battle here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at things in terms of the nascent electric vehicle market, Tesla is clearly either the benchmark or right up there setting the benchmark along with the Nissan Leaf, which is doing really well. And in the case of the Nissan Leaf, they had to cut their price substantially this year to get off ground zero. They were really not doing very well last year. They shifted production to the U.S. They introduced a new cut-rate model and cut prices on even the higher-line vehicles, and they're up over 200%. But Tesla's come out of nowhere. They launched production just last July, so now just barely entering the second year. And things are soaring, and they really surprised everyone yesterday by delivering a profit when the market was expecting a loss.
Is this a branding issue? Tesla going for ultimate sort of sex and performance and Leaf kind of branding itself as the equivalent of driving a bottle of vitamins around for the environment?
Well, yeah, in a way, you're right. The Leaf is certainly a much more affordable car. Ironically, in some cases, by having a high-priced, expensive, sexy vehicle, and it very much is a sexy vehicle. It's a good-looking car.
You've been in it, right? You've driven it, right?
Yeah, not enough. So if the Tesla people listening, get me a vehicle. I need a test drive. I need more time. Anyway, this one is quick. It's sexy. And if you pay as much as $100,000, you can get as much as a 300-mile range battery, which largely overcomes one of the biggest concerns that people have about electric vehicles, which is range. Tesla's doing a lot of other things, by the way. They are giving new battery warranties, essentially a bulletproof warranty. They're setting up a network of high-speed chargers so that, let's say you want to go from, Washington, D.C. to Boston, you can do that without having to stop for 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours to recharge. You can get an 80% recharge in about half an hour, 40 minutes with the vehicle. So these are the steps that are really important to make this particular brand take off.
Tesla and the future of the electric car. Tesla's stock up 300%, more than 300% this year. Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Thanks so much.
Good to be with you, John.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Now to the other big story this week. During the Cold War, you may remember, if a U.S. or Soviet leader canceled a summit meeting, the whole world would hold its breath. But yesterday, President Obama announced his decision to cancel a summit meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the world basically shrugged. Is it only about the granting of asylum to NSA leaker Edward Snowden that has provoked this move, or is it what U.S. officials say are issues of trade, missile defense, and human rights as well? Joining us now to discuss the implications of the cancellation is Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you, John.
So should we be paying attention to this summit meeting, or is it more important to be paying attention to the meeting with the John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, and their Russian counterparts in Washington between now and the end of the week?
I think that meeting on Friday in Washington is much more important. And really, Obama didn't have a choice. Putin gave him a personal slight, and he did just the right thing by giving a personal slight back to Putin.
So how can John Kerry, Secretary of State, and Defense Secretary Hagel accomplish anything significant when it seems as though the White House has put everything with U.S.-Russian relations into a deep freeze? Is Kerry just forging ahead on his own?
I don't think anyone has very high expectations for new cooperation between Russia and the United States at the moment. But it is important to keep the relationship in motion, especially because of U.S.-Russian cooperation and the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and also the need for cooperation against North Korea and Iran.
So would we look for – I mean, because when you were last on this program, you said that it appears as though Putin wants to get out from under this Snowden avalanche. And that in terms of policy, he much more values the other bilateral issues between the U.S. and Russia than this Snowden question and getting a propaganda victory. Does that mean that we could conceivably get a concession on North Korea, get a concession on one of these other issues to maybe bring the relationship back under the tent?
Well, you know, Putin is really trying to balance several different informal groupings that are at the top of the Russian state. And I think where we should be looking right now is whether there's any movement on Syria. Saudi Arabia gave a really interesting proposal yesterday saying that they would buy a large number of armaments from Russia if there were some concession in terms of future UN Security Council resolutions about the Assad regime. So that's where we might see some movement.
Is that conceivably a partly U.S. initiative to get the Saudis to sort of tap the Russians on the shoulder?
I wouldn't be surprised if it's just a recognition that economics as well as security is what's really driving the Putin regime, and that he's trying to balance all of these different individuals who are really at the top trying to influence Russian policy.
Based on your notion of the relationship between Putin and Obama, what's really lost by this meeting not happening? And the president will still be in Russia for the G20.
Well, I think there was a real effort in the spring for the two sides to reach out to each other at a personal level. And my interpretation of this is that Putin just got pushback from people who were more hardliners within his administration, saying that an outreach to Obama wasn't worth it. He did have a choice. He didn't have to give Snowden the year-long ability to stay in Russia. He could have given him a 3-month administrative decision instead.
And he could, of course, reverse at any time, right? I mean, he still has the Snowden card in the sense that he could suddenly decide, Snowden, you looked at me wrong. You're going back to the airport.
We don't know where Snowden is, and I think that's intentional because it does still leave room for a possible U.S.-Russian deal in the future.
So we wouldn't call that asylum. We would call that a prisoner.
Well, there's been an interesting discussion of what happens to people who seek asylum in Russia. They're not always treated all that well by the Russians.
Huh. So Snowden, in a sense, has completely reset the U.S.-Russian relationship in the short term. That's either an indication of the power of Snowden or the fragility of the U.S.-Russian relationship during this Obama second term.
He was an accident that nobody wanted, but I think more than anything else, it demonstrates just how much there's back and forth within the Russian administration, and no one is sure what direction will come next.
What about back and forth in the White House or in the Department of State?
Obama has his own domestic politics to worry about, doesn't he?
But does he have John Kerry to worry about? Would Kerry prefer to do something differently, do you think?
Oh, I think everybody, both the Democrats and the Republicans, supported Obama in the decision that he made yesterday.
Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College, talking about the cancellation yesterday announced by President Obama of a scheduled summit meeting later this year between Vladimir Putin and the president. Kimberly, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We are well into the second generation of Americans struggling with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from the effects of combat. This spring, a veteran from the war in Vietnam wrote this about his own struggle, words he dedicated to young people coming home from combat today. PTSD is a slow, disruptive, and uncaring illness. It will suck up all the good things in your life, like family, friends, and the ability to truly feel. Please, please, please get help, he wrote. But it took that vet more than 40 years to get where he could even say that. He deployed in the 1960s, diagnosed in the late 80s. It took decades more for the Veterans Administration to concede that his PTSD had anything to do with Vietnam. Today, under U.S. law, a vet no longer has to struggle to prove his wartime experiences caused his emotional difficulties. There are treatments and networks of support today that didn't exist a generation ago. They are a gift, you might say, from the Vietnam generation to the generation of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As part of our focus on PTSD this week, we introduced former U.S. Marine Douglas Howell, who went to Vietnam in 1966 and 1967, to retired U.S. Air Force Captain Mary McGriff, 2004 veteran of the Iraq War.
When I was diagnosed with PTSD and depression in 2005, it was taboo. So even though I knew that I had the diagnosis, I refused treatment because of the stigma behind it. My husband and I knew that I came back changed. I was very depressed, cried a lot, didn't know why. It would just happen. So it wasn't until 6 years after that I actually sought treatment.
You know, half of people who are diagnosed with PTSD don't seek treatment. Douglas, how many times did you refuse treatment, would you say, if you can even count?
Oh, my gosh. Certainly more than five or six or seven, eight times. Of course, when I, in 1967, 68, when I got out, PTSD was just beginning to be talked about in the literature. And nobody ever told me that I had PTSD. I just thought I was kind of a screwed up kid, kind of living on the streets and hitchhiking around the country, not feeling like I belonged anywhere. I was really lost for quite a long time.
So, Douglas, what brought you in from the cold? What was the conversation, the person? Was there somebody in your corner that said you needed to really deal with this?
You know, I've asked myself that question 100 times at least, and I'm not sure. Probably a gradual series of events. I was doing an awful lot of drugs, self-medicating so that I could get through the day and night, and mostly the nights. And I began to realize that the drugs were doing damage to me, and the lifestyle of the drugs were doing damage to me. And I also had a girlfriend, and we had a child together. And I came home one day, and I saw the child, and I didn't like the situation that I had put the child in. And I began to say, I got to get my act together. I have seen any number of psychiatrists and psychologists over the years. Of course, none of them help until you really admit and want help. And you're the one that has to open those creaky doors. They can't do it for you. They can only show you the door. So it took me a long time to begin to realize that I needed to talk about my experiences. I needed to sort of open the door and let people see so that I could use them as a mirror and figure out how to work my way back to a more normal life without being afraid of everything around me.
Creaky doors. Does that have meaning for you, Mary?
I started talking to people very little by little because this was at a time that I still wasn't seeking treatment, but I understood the symptoms. Then I felt comfortable enough knowing that they're one of me that I could talk to them and they would understand. So little by little, my creaky doors would end up having some WD-40 and I felt comfortable opening it with certain people. But it is still difficult today to discuss my experience or what I go through with regular civilian or even military members who did not deploy in that type of environment.
Well, let me just keep my mouth shut here. Forget about the civilian in the room here. Mary, what are you most curious about Douglas's experience? Go ahead and ask him.
Doug, do you feel like you have made a difference for yourself and for others?
Yeah. I think I am very proud of myself for standing up to this very difficult condition and facing it and dealing with it. And I feel like I'm happy to say that I have almost a normal life for having done that. The more I do it, the more I talk about it, the more I become comfortable with the ogre in the room, the more I realize that I would really like to do more for other people. I would like to do more to help find a way for people as myself and as you, Captain, to deal with this so that we don't have to go through that, is this someone I can talk to, or is this not someone I can talk to? And how much can I talk about? And how in depth can I go? And what do I say to them when they say, I don't want to hear anymore? You know, I say, sorry, you asked. You're going to hear it.
What are you most curious about Mary's experience, Douglas?
I am curious about how she dealt with relationships, whether she has family and children. And how was she able to maintain that?
That was hard. Fortunately for me, and I know for many others, it's not the same, but I have a very strong and solid marriage. My husband has stuck by me since before I came into the military. So we've been married or together for over 20 years. Our relationship really didn't suffer. But what suffered is me struggling with my symptoms and trying to deal with it and be the strong one and be the leader that I'm expected to be, that nothing, you know, is wrong with me or that I can overcome everything. And it was a facade that not only did I have at work, but I had to have it at home. At least that's how I felt. But through treatment, my second psychologist, who was civilian, got me to the point where when she had me write my trauma account of what I experienced during my 4 months, she later then asked me, have you shared this with your husband and your kids? And I was just flabbergasted. I was like, what are you talking about? I would never share this type of detail and emotion with my kids and my husband. And her question was, why not? And it was a darn good question. I just never thought about it. It was just a piece of my life that I wasn't willing. It was a burden. And I didn't want to burden anybody with it. But she got me through that stage in treatment where I had the nerve to actually read my trauma account, which is 5 pages, out loud to my husband. Then I let my children read it. Then they understood where I was coming from. But I have to accept the fact that I changed. That was the hardest thing because I was spending so much energy all these years trying to be the person I used to be. And it was beating my head against the wall constantly. But I was trying my best to be that person again. But I had to eventually realize that person's gone. I will never be the Mary McGriff from before September 2004. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, it's such an intensely private and invisible struggle. It's a monumental struggle, and it's silent and it's invisible, and it's a difficult road to hoe.
Yeah, and see, Doug, you said something earlier when you were talking about how you want to do more, but you also got to sit back and think that you've done enough so that we can carry on what you started.
Well,
so we will take care of the next generation. I think that's our generational cross to bear now. It's our turn.
I've still got some fight left in me.
Well, let's go.
I'm going to be there. I'm ready.
Hey, Douglas.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Civilian here just for a second.
Yeah.
Do you have one of those trauma accounts?
Yes, sir, I do. I've been back to Vietnam three times since my deployment there. Starting in 2008, a small group of us went back to find a specific site, a jungle mountaintop near the border of Laos, where we suffered immense casualties in the space of 48 hours. It took us 3 years and two trips and an awful lot of study to finally find the site and place some memorials there for our fallen brothers. And I've been back, I just went back this past May for the third time and probably my last time. And I wrote a story about it. The trips back to Vietnam were probably the most therapeutic things I could have ever done, more than any of the shrinks I've seen in my life. Even though I have the effects of war, I'm always leery. I can't go out of my house without the 2 seconds that happen when you open the door. You plan your path to your car. You make it the most expeditious path you can because of that sniper that's going to be out there. Even now, almost 50 years later, it is a brief, fleeting moment, but it happens every single time. If I open the front door to get a newspaper. But after that, I'm okay. I can do that. Going back to Vietnam helped me realize that I have no more enemies over there. And they certainly don't have an enemy in me. The enemy in me are the horrific experiences that I wish on no one. And those will always be there. And what I learned was that I need to accept them and embrace them if I'm going to live with them, because I tried for a long time to run away from them, and that was killing me.
That is one of the most, difficult challenge is when people think that PTSD is like a rash. It's going to go away, and it's not. So
yes, ma'am.
When people say, get over it, or, oh, God, it's been 50 years. You shouldn't be thinking about that stuff already. Those are the people that do not understand. And that is why I have such difficulty talking to people that did not experience what I did, because then I have to try to explain something that they will never understand. And I don't feel that there's a need or that I'm going to end up getting the result that I would like for them to get. So why bother?
Well, to both of you, let me just note that you're speaking to about 1 million people who don't know this experience, who haven't had this experience right now.
True, but then I've got to wonder, what are they thinking? And I understand that PTSD also is not just from war. There's PTSD from sexual assault. It could be car accident, witnessing a murder or being threatened and whatnot. I mean, there's so many ways that PTSD can creep up on somebody. And I know that we're focused right now just on the war part of it. So maybe those people can understand better. But then there's that other population that are like, you know, Doug, I don't know if you can agree with me, but it still happens today. Did you kill anybody?
Oh yeah. Did you shoot anybody? Did you kill anybody?
Yeah.
And you're so right on about the people that just don't get it. And I mean, imagine 40 years ago, there were even fewer people that got it. And, you know.
It's not something to be proud of. I mean, to live with that type of guilt.
That's
for
really
the rest of your life.
Point. Yeah.
And then somebody just asks like it's a video game. It's like, no, you know, they didn't pop right back up. You didn't buy another life. You know, they died. It's over. Finished. There's no going back. So that is one of the worst questions to ask a veteran is, you know, if they have had to kill anybody or if they've seen anybody dying or die or whatever. I mean, that's one of the most horrific things that we have to see and experience. We don't want to talk about it. That's just not the thing to talk about.
Or no medals to put on your chest for this kind of experience.
You're right. There isn't.
Can I try for a question that actually I think you both might have an answer for? According to the Pentagon and the VA, it's roughly on the order of 400,000, 500,000 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who are believed to be diagnosed or diagnosable as having PTSD. That's, you know, 500,000 people plus their family members. Any advice for this nation on what we're going to be dealing with over the next 50 years?
It's only going to get worse because you still have people who are afraid to talk because they have their career or their next job to think about. You don't want to be perceived by other people as not being capable of doing certain jobs. You don't want to be judged by your condition. Then not only that, when you mentioned family, that's secondary PTSD. That's another group of individuals that need treatment as well. It's just going to be worse than what it is right now, I think, in my opinion. Doug, what do you think?
You know, I come to understand over the last few years that it's even more complex an issue than I thought it was when I first began to realize my own difficulties and situation with it. There are all sorts of levels and reasons, causation for PTSD. For some people, it may take a really horrific act or scene or condition or situation for them to have it bother them. And for some people, maybe not so lengthy an act, maybe a simple witnessing of a robbery or something. PTSD is not a black and white issue. And PTSD is this great, big, ugly blob of gray.
True.
I don't know. I wish I was smart. I wish I was smart enough to give you an answer that America could take and put in their pocket and run away with. But I don't know what America can do. I think what they can do is listen.
Well, I think some of them are listening, and this is why I say that. When you came back from Vietnam, you came back to an environment that was unappreciative. Very anti-war and anti-vet, unfortunately. For us, we have nonprofits available. In my situation, having been in the Air Force, I did not deploy with a unit. I deployed in a three-man team and worked with people from bases all over the world. So I didn't have, you know, 50 people that I knew. And when I came back from that environment, I had literally nobody to talk to. But then when I joined the Wounded Warrior Project, it was completely different. Everything that I needed, that I was missing, they had it. You know, I went to a support group with other women, officers and enlisted, that had PTSD. It was like God's gift to me, you know, for my recovery. That's what I needed. I needed to meet other men and women from my generation, that we could actually talk to each other. We don't have to explain in detail because we're suffering from similar things. So we are comfortable hugging each other and sobbing on each other's arms or shoulder because we understand. And it's amazing. It's like a bond that's already been created for us through the war. It's just a matter of finding each other.
I also have begun to be involved in a group called Run for Veterans, R4V. And you're right, Mary, this is wonderful for these people. And for me and for all of us. And what I wanted to say when you said that we can hold each other and we can cry on each other's shoulders, and it takes almost no words because we all just understand. We know who we are. And we don't have to talk about it because there really aren't any words. But having someone who understands me, just that I can put my arm around and say, hey, how you doing, man? That is really, really comforting.
Douglas Howell was a Marine Corpsman in the Navy during the Vietnam War. He joined us from WDET in Detroit. And retired Captain Mary McGriff from the United States Air Force, who served in Iraq. Stations around the country have been profiling Americans struggling with PTSD for some time. Here's an example from KQED San Francisco. We'll leave you today with the voice of Daniel Acree, who can't get over what he saw in Iraq.
I couldn't sit in class anymore. I had to leave. And I didn't, you know, the panic, the heart is palpitating, and your heart breathing, and your blood is boiling, and all of the all the different memories coming back. I just couldn't go on.
More voices tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.